Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
May it please the Court. In 1995, the first parcel in a virtual city block assemblage was acquired to build what is now the Ritz-Carlton on Canal Street. In 1997, after 3 years of assembling the property from multiple purchasers, multiple buildings, multiple owners, after designing a 450-room Ritz-Carlton and associated hotels, after obtaining financing, after having both architectural plans and specifications and negotiated a construction contract with a construction budget in place with detailed line items, this taxpayer made a conservation easement, a perpetual transfer of real property rights to the Preservation Resource Center to preserve the historic character of that building in perpetuity. At the time, the taxpayer did not look to the local professional community, but looked to the national professional community and obtained the services of Richard Cohen from Philadelphia, an eminent expert and author who was one of the co-authors with the National Trust of an appraising easements treatise to value and provide the qualified appraisal of the valuation of the charitable donation attendant to this easement. And that determination was that on a project which was going to cost in the hundreds of millions of dollars, that the valuation of that perpetual easement and restriction and loss of development rights was $7,445,000. That was 16 years ago this past December. In 2006, the tax court did its first review of this valuation determination. The Internal Revenue Service, utilizing a revenue engineer internally without obtaining the services of an MAI or an outside appraiser, determined that the value of the donation was $1,150,000. In advance of trial, the Internal Revenue Service obtained an appraisal, and that appraisal determined that the valuation was zero, not $1,150,000. By the time of trial in 2006, Mr. Cohen suffered from degenerative Parkinson's disease, was unable to testify. So again, this taxpayer looked to the national community of professionals and hired another eminently qualified expert, Richard Roderwig from Chicago. Mr. Roderwig did a retrospective appraisal, utilizing or attempting to utilize all three appraisal methodologies, determined that the fair market value at the time of the donation in 1997 was $10 million, but that the taxpayer was limited to the previous deduction that had been taken. 3 years after trial, in 2009, the tax court issued its first decision in this matter, finding that the value was none of the foregoing values, but rather was $1,792,000. The tax court rejected Mr. Roderwig's conclusions across the board, adopted the rationale of Mr. Argodi, and made the determination that there was not only a different value, but that that different value resulted in an overvaluation and assessed a 40% overvaluation penalty.
Counsel, you're going through a long history, and I know there's a lot to this. Let me ask you, on the second go-around in the tax court, where the judge said the before value, well, he used just comparable sales and said the before value was $23.50 per square foot, post value was $20. Best I could tell from his analysis, it looked to me as if he was giving almost no value to the easement at all. Were those Argotti's figures, the $23.50 and the $20, and the only thing he did was change the square footage because of the Crest Building dispute that we had resolved to some extent the first time? Just where do those numbers come from, those square footage numbers? And to the extent the difference is there a comparable cell that Argote had that said once you have a burden like this, it would be diminished in value to that extent?
Judge Southwick, the numbers are exactly the same in the second tax court opinion as they were in the first tax court opinion. The 2350 was the derived number that the tax court itself determined as the before value.
But not based on Argote's comparables?
Based on its own extrapolation. The $20 figure was based on Argote.
So how do you get an easement value out of the 2350? I mean, I guess what was the tax court doing first or second time, since I didn't see much in the opinion the second time, to say that the easement would have reduced the value that much per square foot, of any amount per square foot?
Your Honor, it's hard to discern what the tax court was doing the second time. The second opinion reads much like the first, and in addressing all of the what we felt to be a very express mandate coming out of the prior panel, simply and not intending to be flip, it was same song, second verse. It was, I looked at this before, I still see it the same way I was right the first time.
Mr. Elkins, there were, as I understand the record, I think five comparables here in New Orleans, and it was through those comparables that Argote or Argote came up with his $20 per square foot, and it was those comparables that the court used the $2,350. I mean, but it seems to me that they have. The tax court has the ability and the authority to make factual decisions and to come to their own conclusions as to the value of land. Is that correct?
They certainly do, but they must do it in the spirit of the mandate of the previous panel, Judge Garza, that you participated in.
But, our previous panel wanted more information from them before we made a final decision. And they seem to have plugged those holes up in the second opinion. Here's my problem with much of what you say. First thing is you're touting your own expert when it seems to me that the legal question is how did the tax court get it wrong? That to me is the question before us, not how good your expert is or what his evaluations are, but how did the tax court get it wrong? That's number one. The second thing that the background of this case is something that you seem to have conceded in your brief, and there's two points. The first one is this quote: "The easement was donated after the consolidation of the property was substantially completed, and its development into a Ritz-Carlton hotel was assured." That is to say, and this is running through a lot of these evaluations, that the 60 additional rooms that could have been bought, could have been built, had not been built before. And these 60 rooms, after after Ritz-Carlton came into play, and I presume they had a lease on this property, and or was it transferred? The ownership was transferred to them.
They had a recorded management contract.
Management contract. But afterwards, they had agreed not to build those 60 rooms. And what's running behind everything, it seems to me that the fair, whether or not we need to calculate, or whether or not the tax court should have calculated their fair market value, given those facts that underline this particular case. And I have one other thing, but I want you to comment on that, because it's important to me to know and understand how that impacts fair market value before and after.
Well, I think that the development plan was in place, and the importance of conceding that fact was that in determining square footage, the tax court had not made a clear finding of highest and best use, and the concession of the fact that it was going to be a Ritz-Carlton was that that established the highest and best use.
I thought that both experts agreed that whether it was a luxury hotel or just a hotel, that it did not make that difference.
That's not my understanding of the facts, Your Honor, at all.
I thought I read that in your brief.
No. You read that in the tax court's opinion. You read that in the tax court's opinion because after this court issued a mandate to the tax court saying there was a determination that it was going to be a Ritz-Carlton, all of these factors were in place, you need to reach a clear decision as to highest and best use. And was that as a Ritz-Carlton luxury hotel or was that as a non-luxury hotel?
If it was the Ritz-Carlton and they agreed to abide by the easement, which they did, which excludes the 60 additional rooms, how is the fair market value after the easement changed in any way?
It reduces the ability to build the 60 rooms. That is the essence of the before and after valuation differential.
That brings me to my second point, which is another fact. There sure wasn't a run on purchasers of this particular building that wanted to build a hotel. In fact, there wasn't a run on a lot of hotel space that was here at that time anyways. And what effect is that there was, you know, that your clients were really the only people that wanted to purchase this particular piece of property and make it into the hotel that they were dreaming of?
I'm not sure that the record shows that they were the only people interested, but I think that goes to the point that Mr. Roderick made, and that is that the value and that properties such as this that are in excess of a half million square feet, buildings in excess of a half million square feet with historic characteristics located on Canal Street two blocks from Bourbon are a unique resource. And the market for those is not the local hotel non-luxury developer that might do a Hilton Garden Inn or a Motel 6.
Now, whoa, okay. You know, that's a kind of almost a so easy to go from the local market to the national market, but what is the rationale? What is the rationale that the experts should not be using the local market to determine valuation?
The rationale, and there were numerous treatises and guidelines from the Appraisal Institute on exactly this issue, and in fact citation of case law from the tax court when it said that when a property has unique characteristics and trades in a national marketplace, state lines are blurred and you look
again,
to the relevant market.
Yeah, once again, trade in a national marketplace. I thought that you just said that the White House partnership still owned, and the only thing that they used, I mean, the only contract with the Ritz-Carlton was a management contract. That still is a focus, a local focus, not a national focus, it seems to me.
I'm not sure. The Ritz-Carlton is a national chain.
So what? It's not the owner. It's the manager of this property.
It is the flag. It is the identity. It is the basis for the economics. It puts heads in beds. It establishes the standards of operation, the cost of operation, the cost of a room night. It is integral to the determination of value and to the standards to which the construction has to be made. You could substitute Four Seasons. You could substitute any other major.
This is another problem that I see with this case. We're only talking about the easement. Is that correct? We're valuing the easement. Is that correct?
We're valuing the easement.
And I guess what you're saying is under the income approach that all of this makes more sense that the that is to say the amount of income, because it is such an interesting parcel and it's such a historical parcel, that the valuation would increase because the income around it would increase.
We believe we've cited authorities that that is the only appropriate thing. But I realize my time, if I may eat into a little bit of my minutes.
I'm sorry.
No. Give him three more minutes and then give the other side. There's a whole lot in this. That's an understatement. But give him three more minutes and give the other side. And you can complete. No. You can complete responding to Judge Goskos and making it. I mean, this case has just got a whole lot, so we're not rushed. We want to know the answers.
Judge Garza, there's an overlying issue that that I think is very important, and I think is very crucial to the reconsideration of this the second time, and that is the nature and extent of the mandate. And Judge Barksdale, in writing for the previous panel that you participated in, wrote a very, very clear mandate. The Fifth Circuit's enunciation of the mandate rule is it grows out of the law of the case, and that neither the lower court nor even a subsequent panel of this court is free to revisit those issues. In writing for the previous panel, Judge Barksdale wrote.
Hold on, because you're going to use up to 3 minutes reading to us.
No, I've got two sentences, Judge, and it's crucial to my argument.
All right, I'm going to exercise the prerogative. Tell me this. Number one, is your argument here rising and falling on our agreeing with you that the tax court did not abide by the mandate of
yes.
the court? All right. I got you on a yes, all right?
Yes.
So I want to be clear, all right, on that part. All right. So that said, if we disagree with you, where are you with the rest of your argument vis-a-vis the ultimate relief that you can you get relief from us other than us buying or agreeing that he violated the mandate?
That subsumes the question. If you assume that he accurately followed the mandate, then we have no basis for being before you a second time.
All right. I want to be clear on the position, not to cut you off. So it's very much central to your argument that we read that and view it and appreciate it as a derogation of the mandate that you said same song, second verse is basically what you're arguing.
And the basic premise of the mandate.
Yeah, read that.
I've got two sentences.
I got you on the record.
Several threshold matters are clear. We read this in the previous mandate in the previous opinion as a conclusion of law which is reviewed de novo. Certainly there's a factual underpinning, but this is the interpretation of the contract, the application of the law to the facts. White House owned both the Maison Blanche and Crest buildings on the day the easement was conveyed. Because of the easement, White House could not build on top of the Crest building. We believe that that is a finding, that is a legal conclusion that binds the tax court. Judge Barksdale went on to reiterate, any future owner would be precluded from constructing rooms. That loss of opportunity would reduce the amount a willing buyer would pay for the parcel and therefore would reduce its fair market value. We believe that to be a conclusion of law. On remand, the tax court said, we see daylight to revisit that issue. And in looking for daylight and looking for a loophole, the tax court concluded that there was no prohibition on constructing the additional 60 rooms, and nothing in the second opinion accords any value to the loss of those development rights. We believe the loss of development rights was a finding of this court and the previous panel and integral to the mandate and was entirely disregarded.
All right, well, the panel may have some questions based on that latter one. Judge Garth, you on the panel. You want to?
Yeah,
I'm up on that one.
Let's hear from the other side first, and then I'll ask some more questions because there's some other findings that were on that opinion.
All right, we've got it teed up. Here comes the government solo at the table. So we help us understand. Let's start with the question, at least that I ask, and that is if so much is riding on the tax court's determination? What's the government's view vis-a-vis following the mandate, that aspect? Not cutting you off from other parts of the argument, but let's just steer. What's the government's view?
We believe that the tax court did follow the mandate in that it computed a value for the easement, taking into account the inability to build the 60 rooms after the donation. Now, there is a section in the opinion where the tax court seems to revisit the legal effect of the easement. We did not re-argue that in the brief because we believe that in the opinion, the tax court is very clear that it went on to make its valuation and to do its computations based on the assumption that the 60 additional rooms could not be built.
Well, counsel, that is a fairly significant length percentage of the opinion where he goes through Louisiana Civil Code and basically tells the Fifth Circuit they don't understand Louisiana law. Neither here nor there who was right on that. The Fifth Circuit had ruled and was the law of the case. There is language in here where the tax judge then says, I've now gotten that off my chest, I will follow the Fifth Circuit, which says I'm supposed to consider that there cannot be construction on top of the crest because of the easement. I will say that's a troubling part of the opinion where the tax judge disagrees with it and then says, trust me, I'm still going to consider what I was ordered to do. As I understand the opinion, tax judge, he is saying that to build the six extra stories would not have added value to the project. Is that a fair assessment of the analysis?
I think he made a factual finding that the six extra stories would not have been built.
Wouldn't have been built, that it's not economically feasible, that the building had all the rooms it could possibly use. I don't know if he necessarily used language like that, and it would not have added value, sort of like on a homeowner building something, you're not going to get the value back when you sell it, that building this would not have added to the value or would not have been done at all. What we are looking at, are we not, on this charitable deduction, is the before and the effect on the before and after value, before and after the transfer of the easement.
Yes.
Can you get into the cost figures that the trial tax court used in here, the $23.50 and the $20?
Yes.
Because the tax judge seems to be saying there's almost no value at all, and yet still has this $3.50 difference. Is this, so where does that come from?
The $23.50 figure in first tax court opinion, the tax court judge explains he based that figure on four local properties that both experts agreed were comparable to the Maison Blanche building and the Crest building, the local buildings that both experts included in their list of comparables. And then he made certain adjustments to them as the experts had for the size of the buildings, proximity to the French Quarter, issues like that.
Adjustments that got to $23.50.
And adjustments that got to $23.50.
Okay.
That was something he did in the first opinion, and the selection of those local comparables and those adjustments has actually not been objected to by either side.
What I'm trying to get to is how does he then get to 20? How does he factor in the value of the burden of this easement on a potential arm's length purchase?
The $20 figure is from Argotti's, we've been saying. Appraisal. That's based on, I believe, five comparable properties here in New Orleans that were already subject to conservation easements or similar easements when they were sold. So they're looking, it's sort of basic to the use of the before and after method, that there's no market in easements, but there is a market in properties subject to easements. Of course, especially in a place like New Orleans where there's a lot of historic properties and there's just like there's sales of properties in a historic district, there are also sales of properties subject to easements.
So there seemed to be almost no consideration given to the burden of that easement on this property. Your brief, maybe the tax court opinion too, gets into how Ritz-Carlton itself would have had some of these obligations on the owner of the building to maintain the facade. But it does seem to me that there's very limited consideration in the tax judge's opinion about the obligations on the part of the owner of the building that arise from the easement. And I don't see you who have challenged the figure that $8 million has been spent on the facade so far. What do you make of that question? Not that it's an unfair question. What's the answer?
The answer is that it's not just a question of whether they spent money on the easement. The question is whether they would have spent that money on the facade. The question is whether they would have spent money on the facade absent the easement.
Well, I mean, I think the question on fair market value is, would if somebody who purchases that with the easement realize the kind of expense and therefore would alter the price it would be willing to pay for a building burdened by that prospective expense? And did the comparables for the $20 take into account those sorts of burdens?
Those are buildings that are subject, the comparables for the $20 are buildings that are subject to conservation easements. I believe those easements are held by the same conservation, the same donee.
Ms. Hauser, how about one of the things that's puzzling to me is there's a couple things. Please, if you could just comment on it. There was some discussion that I thought that the Ritz-Carlton would not build these new rooms because they had a policy that every room had to have a window looking outside, and that somehow that could impact the valuation of the easement. That's number one. And number two, factually, this statement that the easement was donated after the consolidation of the property was substantially completed and its development into Ritz-Carlton was assured. That is to say that the Ritz-Carlton obviously knew that there was going to be an easement there. Now, this doesn't obviously make it a matter of law, but it's some evidence as to the valuation, it seems to me, of this particular easement by the Ritz-Carlton, by the acceptance of this easement that would have prohibited these 60 rooms. Just comment on that. I may be absolutely wrong on my deductions.
I suppose what I would say to comment on that is that, yes, I believe the tax court made a finding that the building of the additional, one of the factors that would weigh against building additional rooms, in addition to the fact that it had not been shown that it would be feasible, was that by building those additional rooms over the Crest building, they would cut off the view from other rooms, and that would be contrary to the Ritz-Carlton the Ritz-Carlton development guidelines.
How about the fact that, you know, that
I suppose about the fact that it was assured of development into a Ritz-Carlton, to me that seems to indicate that the historic nature of the building and the beauty of the facade were themselves attractive components of the building. In fact I think Mr. Elkins said as much when he was up here just before. That is what makes that parcel so unique, and unique among parcels on Canal Street in New Orleans. It's of course a value that comes with many costs, but if the consequence is that you can operate a Ritz-Carlton there.
In comparison to a building, additional rooms, the uniqueness of the facade tends to overweigh the expediency or the efficiency of building additional rooms. That's
yes.
What makes it, that the land gets more of a value from the facade, I guess, than it does from the addition of additional rooms.
There are certainly, you know, glass towers in this area that maybe have more rooms, but yes, that's the idea. Is that
One other question, because I I'm asking you, but Mr. Elkins, you gotta pipe in on this.
Later.
Because the tax court went on comparable sales.
Yes.
As the approach.
Yes.
It did not go on reproduction.
Yes.
Because it would be unreasonable for someone to try to reproduce this particular
yes.
facade if it was completely destroyed. Secondly, it did not go into an income approach because supposedly there are too many variables, too subjective, and whatever else they particularly said. Now, why in the government's opinion, or in the IRS's opinion, is the comparable sales approach the best approach to value the land, excuse me, to value the easement, not the land, but the easement that is the basis of this donation?
Comparable sales is a good method for, with the before and after method, is a good method for valuing easements, because they can show you whether restrictions that are placed on property actually diminish the fair market value to a great extent or to a small extent, or whether the value, the historic nature of the building is bringing enough to the buyers of such properties that they have either no effect or a small effect on the overall value of the building, of the properties. And they can show you that by looking at what the market is actually doing rather than speculating about what people might want.
On the highest and best use, pretty clear statement in Judge Barksdale's opinion that that had to be considered on remand. As I understand the tax court's opinion, fairly explicitly said that I'm not going to choose between luxury and non-luxury, highest and best use, and explained himself. Would you defend, if that's your position, what the tax court did on highest and best use?
What the tax court did on highest and best use was to cite some auction theory and a seventh related Seventh Circuit opinion that say highest and best use, sorry, that
pull it to
the mic. Yeah,
there you go.
Thank you, sir. That indicate that the highest and best use will not control the price of property if there are other suitable properties so that the buyer is in a position, so it's a buyer's market, so that the buyer can choose which property to buy for his purposes. And the tax court here thought, I think, found that theory attractive because this parcel was purchased just a few years before the easement was donated at a price that did not seem to reflect any kind of national markup for Ritz-Carlton use, and that's despite the fact that it was purchased for the purpose of developing it into a Ritz-Carlton. In fact, the Crest Building was purchased after the contract was signed with Ritz-Carlton. So despite those facts, this property was purchased without that kind of a markup. Auction theory is a sort of theoretical underpinning for why it might be possible to purchase property that might have high income potential without incorporating that high income potential into the purchase price of the property.
Well, did the tax judge basically hold it doesn't matter, that the value would be the same as a luxury and a non-luxury?
He did say that that the highest and best use did not matter. And one of the points that we made is that that's been made here is that neither expert thought that the easement would change the highest and best use, putting aside the 60 rooms.
Say that again, because I thought I'd made that point, and Mr. Elkins said, nope, that ain't that. Both experts.
Mr. Rodwig thought that the highest and best use before the donation was as a Ritz-Carlton, and he thought the highest and best use after the donation was as a Ritz-Carlton. And Mr. R. Goetz thought that the highest and best use before the donation was as a non-luxury hotel, and that the highest and best use after the donation was as a non-luxury hotel. So there's on either approach, on either highest and best use, the factors that are specific to that are unaltered by the donation itself.
Well, can you comment on the fact that this was clearly going to become a Ritz-Carlton? There is something in the tax court opinion, I believe, that where either Argote or somebody testified that sometimes a project could be at this stage and still ultimately never be developed, so that wasn't totally controlling. But the definition, if you adopt it, that's in the tax court opinion of highest and best is the reasonably probable, so it is looking at factual situations and legal use, no question there, of land that is physically possible, appropriately supported, and financially feasible, and that results in its highest value. Do you accept that definition?
Yes.
If I read it correctly, but that is,
yeah.
That
yeah,
is in
I
the tax,
accept one.
Tax court opinion. Well, then what, looking at probabilities, physically possible, appropriately supported, isn't the highest and best Why isn't the highest and best use of this land then as a luxury hotel? I mean, that's what's lined up and is reasonably probable to happen.
What the tax court held was that even assuming that the highest and best use was as a luxury hotel, under auction theory, it would be the second best use that would control the value of the property. That was the tax court's reasoning.
Okay. And you think that is consistent with the mandate of this court? Hard question, huh?
I would also suggest that the tax court all but found that the highest and best use was as a Ritz-Carlton hotel.
Okay. Did you have anything you planned to say before we jumped in on this?
There are so many issues in this case. I could talk about additional ones. Certainly, if you have questions, I would be happy.
Well, you know, it's moving, you know, to target, you know, with a lot of concepts here. I struggle as a Louisiana judge because we don't do easements, you know, we do servitudes, and so this is permeated with all this common law terminology, but, you know, what do I know? Tax court said we didn't know the law anyway, so at any event, so I'm dealing with easements with my common law colleagues, but, you know, I'm up to snuff, I think, but I don't mean to make light of it, but I'm just saying intermingling all these concepts within the concept, but I did want to know, and I think you've addressed the divergent view about, you know, whether this whole deal is turning so much on whether the tax court's fidelity, you know, and all that stuff. Our typical viewpoint is we can affirm or do whatever based on what the record supports, and not the appeal is from the judgment and not from the reasons. So we get lots of appeals where the judges say a lot of things that we don't necessarily embrace. So I don't want to get too far into what he said, yada, yada, versus what this record, you know, supports one way or another in the question. So I think we're pretty clear on the various views of what he said and all that. But burying in on the core question, you know, at issue in terms of this valuation. I mean, we get these battles of experts all the time, and at first glance, I thought, well, is this a case of a battle of experts? The tax court decided one versus the other, but it seems more complicated than that. The amicus brief, which I glanced at, you know, says, well, if we don't rebuke what the tax court does, this is going to set back, you know, appraisers and people who do this in the context, you know, way back. And I don't know if it's an overstatement, but I guess I'll just ask you. I mean, obviously this case has some interest, if you will, in doing this, and we want to get it right. So is it just the question of this taxpayer's deduction in this case of, you know, for tax proof, what are the implications of what we say here vis-a-vis this landscape?
I think that this case is fairly unique. It's a fairly unique piece of property. The tax court, in its opinion, was careful when it disregarded the reconstruction cost and when it disregarded the income cost. It was careful to talk about the facts of this particular case. I don't know that there are going to be that many more cases where you have terracotta facades on Canal Street. So these are... the tax court was careful to say that reconstruction cost can be useful in some cases. It just didn't seem useful here because it seemed like no business would ever reasonably reconstruct that facade, for example.
Ms. Hassel, let me ask you one question about the mandate, because
yes,
part of the mandate says on remand for reevaluation, again, for reevaluation, this highest and best use issue necessarily comes back into play and must be considered. And then at the very tail end, it says, we remand it for further, quote, subsidiary findings necessary to render its ultimate conclusions comprehensible, or, if necessary, to modify its conclusions to conform to the evidence. Now, it seems to me that that pretty much gave the tax court, it told them, reevaluate everything, but come to your own conclusions and make absolutely sure this time to be more specific.
That certainly seems to be how the tax court understood it as well, Your Honor.
If that satisfies, can I ask you about the good faith exception? It seems to me that's an extraordinarily important part of this case. There was an appraisal. We've heard today about the significance of the appraiser who was doing the appraisal. What is the validity of the tax court's opinion here that reliance on that sort of appraisal, which is done in some contexts all the time, is not good faith? Can you walk us through why this is defensible?
I think the tax court was saying there needs to be something more, that a sophisticated taxpayer cannot blindly rely on an appraiser. And here I think the tax court was taking into consideration that the partnership is in the business of purchasing and reconstructing properties for profit. They're sophisticated buyers in the real estate market, and they should have had a strong sense of what the true value of the property was.
Was that because they purchased it at, I think it's $11 million, and the deduction taken 3-4 years later was $7 million, and that's almost 70% or whatever, 65%?
I think the tax court thought they should have been thunderstruck, I think, by the size of the diminution in value what they had purchased.
As I understood the record, that supposedly should have raised the red flag.
Yes.
As to these, maybe not experts in valuation, but pretty knowledgeable people in the purchase of property around here.
Right. And I think that the tax court did say it was specific to the taxpayer. So if you were looking at a private family that had owned the same property for 100 years, that might be they might be more reasonable in placing reliance on the appraiser.
Well, is there something specifically erroneous about the figures are being used? As the before and after value of the conveyance at the time of the easement was being conveyed, whatever year that was, and the appraisal said $95 million beforehand and $88 million after, or something like that. Is that number in and of itself invalid?
Well, there are two problematic parts with that original, the Cohen appraisal. One is that it valued the building as an ongoing concern and not as a shell, which it was a shell on the date of the donation, and so that's how it should have been valued.
Is that a black and white issue? It can't not have been worth $95 million on the day before or the day of the conveyance of this easement. It was what it was on that day, and nobody would have paid $95 million for it. Is that your position or the tax court's petition?
These are properties that people purchased for $11 million just a few years before. Yes, there had been plans. Yes, there was a contract with Ritz-Carlton, but all of the construction was still to be done.
That type of approach that he used is very speculative when it comes to future income, depending on many, many things, as Katrina pretty much pointed out, especially down here.
Also, I was just going to say the Cohen appraisal also did not value the Crest building and made no mention or thought about those extra 60 rooms that apparently no one was ever considering at that time. If there are no other questions,
all right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. Back to you, Ms. Elkins.
So much to cover in such little time.
Okay, Mr. Elkins, I got my pen ready.
Judge Southwick, let me address your point first. You ask how did the tax court get to $20, and how does that $20 figure factor in the effect of the easement? It's very important that $20 figures in no effect of the easement. That $20 figure is a direct recitation from the Argodi appraisal, which the previous panel found incredible and unbelievable, which valued the effect of the easement at zero. So using the $20.
But the $20 were based on comparables in New Orleans area that had easements of some sort.
No, it was not, and we disagree with that. That was strongly objected to at trial. The tax court took the easy way out. The tax court said we don't have to think about reproduction or cost method, so we're not going to go there simply because we decided that the test is whether a prudent businessman would choose to rebuild that property. And based upon that test, no one would ever do that. Wrong test. The test is what is required under the easement, not a prudent businessman test. Under the easement, the requirement is to reconstruct. Under the facts in front of the tax court, There already had been $8 million of reconstruction made pursuant to the easement, but the tax court punted on that because they said we've got comparables. We don't need to do that.
But the government disputes a little bit of your interpretation. My understanding of what it says is you must reconstruct so long as the cost isn't more than the value of the overall property or something of that nature. There's a restriction.
And in that event, the easement...
Is that it? I mean, it's just, what is that limitation?
There is a requirement of reconstruction, but I was going to say what goes hand in glove with that is the obligation to insure for replacement value and to accord a 10% stake in the insurance proceeds. So in the event
that the easement says that?
Yes, it does. So in the event you have a $200 million building that a prudent businessman wouldn't rebuild, and you have $200 million of replacement value insurance, the easement calls for a $20 million payment to the donee and calls for the maintaining of that insurance and that additional cost in perpetuity to provide that benefit. So
that would be $2 million, right?
10% of $200 million is $20 million. The donation was 7.4.
You're saying $200 million.
$200 million. The record shows that the book value was over $206 million.
Yeah. Okay. That's the assumption. Okay. Great.
So the tax court said we've got comparables. The comparables were strenuously objected to at trial. There are multiple appraisals in the record. The REVAC appraisal that was done for the lender said we can't find comparables in this marketplace, so we have to go outside of the marketplace. There are none. The Cohen appraisal didn't use comparables because he couldn't find comparables in the marketplace. And it's very important to know what Rodewig did in the comparable area. Rodewig went to the donee organization and identified every single commercial operation that was subject to a donation in favor of this donee. There were 15 of them. He contacted all of them. 11 of them agreed to personal interviews, and he interviewed all 11 of them, and they gave him information as to the burdens and the difficulty of complying with this on an ongoing basis. He only found one of the universe of donated properties that had changed hands and interviewed the purchaser, and the purchaser said, gee, I didn't even know there was a donation when I bought it, so I didn't know to ask any questions. So Rodewig found no before and after comparables. The tax court simply took Easy Street and said, Rodewig said $20, Argote said $20, he said no value, we're going to use that. But more important, what the tax court did the second time around was sixth grade math. They said, in the mandate, we were told that we didn't read the Treasury regulations, neither did Argote, which says that you look at the greater parcel, you look at the effect of the donation on contiguous property under common ownership, and you include the effect on the value of the crest of the loss of the 60 rooms. So somehow, conceiving that it's doing lip service to satisfy the mandate, the tax court said we have X square feet of shell building in the Maison Blanche building. We have Y square feet in the Crest building. X plus Y is 520,000 square feet. That includes nothing with respect to the loss of 60 rooms, which is another 33,000 square feet. Multiply that by $2,350, that's your before value. Multiply that by $20, that's your after value. Boom, you get $65,000 increase in value as a result of our response to the mandate. We believe that the logic is missing, the analysis is missing. We believe that the wrong test was even applied. Judge Southwick, you talk about the before and after methodology. The test that the tax court applied, which is nowhere in the regulations, is quantifiable probability. They said, sure, Mr. Rodewig showed that it was legally permissible and physically possible and financially feasible, which are the tests. And he took 15 pages of his analysis to show the economics that if you build a Ritz-Carlton room, I think he valued it in his report at $238,000. You're going to be paying $250, $300 a night. You lose 60 of those rooms in perpetuity. What is the value of that? And he found it to be financially feasible.
You've got to,
but the before.
You've got a red light. So I know your passion is there. I'll try to give you as much time. It's here, and we what? All right.
May I make one final comment on Judge Southwick's
concluding sentence
on reasonable basis? The tax court did not look and did not accord any value to the fact that prior to receiving the Cohen appraisal, which should have shocked its conscience, it had received the REVAT appraisal of the same property in the before value for commercial loan purposes, which had delivered an even higher value. So when the Cohen appraisal came in, a reasonable business person exercising reasonable care in good faith would say, for lending purposes, it's worth this much. My facade appraiser is using more conservative values. It appears reasonable to me. That extra action was accorded no reasonable consequence in the context of the of the penalty, and had the service been applied the same standard compared to its appraisal, the services assessment would have been subject to evaluation penalty due to its error.
All right. Thank you, Mr. I take it you're not looking for another remand.
No, Your Honor, we didn't get a chance to address that, but we believe the record is very clear, and that there are detailed factual bases to find that this taxpayer did exactly the right thing at every stage, and that the tax court's decision is neither fair, just, nor correct, and that a second vacation and remand would be same song, third verse.
All right, that's why I wanted to get you on the record to be sure I was clear about
you relief. Clearly understood, Your Honor.
All right. Thank counsel for both sides. Before we do the final argument,